Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back for a brand new episode of Ladies Night. I know I say this all the time, but I swear I'm especially excited for this one because I have one of the stars of Ted Lasso with me, Hannah Waddingham. Hello. And I cannot congratulate you on that show enough. Congratulate you and thank you because you and the team, I feel like there was no show that I needed in my life more than what Ted Lasso wound up being this past year.
Bless you. And who knew? My gosh, even us in it. I don't think we knew what it was going to be until we saw it all spliced together. And then all of us went, oh my God, this is a crazy privilege. I can't believe I'm in this. You know, when you dig the other people that you're in scenes with already, and then you see what they create from scratch, it's like tingly, tingly.
It's so special. So the fact that I was hiding before is out in our backyard, we have a stray cat that comes by to visit all the time, and I feed him every day, and we finally just named him, and we name all of the pets in this household after our favorite movies and shows, so the backyard cat is now Ted.
Oh my God, does Jason know this?
No.
Oh my God, I'm going to enjoy telling him that a very lovely stray cat has been named after him.
We just bought Ted a house. I should hang a Believe sign on that house.
Oh my God, you do need to hang a Believe sign on the house. That's so cute.
All right. I teed up the dice tower for you a little. That's what this is. This is the big reveal. Okay. So we're going to go credit by credit and make our way to Ted Lasso. But I always love talking about a lot of random things. So in an effort to contain myself, I come up with 8 questions that I really want to ask, but I only roll the dice 3 times. And whatever 3 questions we get, that's what we're going with for the first portion of the show.
So I love that you have to contain yourself. I'm exactly the same. So this interview could have rambled on for 4 days, to be fair.
I am so spoiled with the amount of time I have for these, and it's still never enough. We got a 3. Ah, I like this one. Filming 101. What is a seemingly silly question about the way that films and shows are made that you were afraid to ask when you first started out?
Ooh, that's a really good question. And the first thing that springs to my mind is on camera, they're like, no, because you're looking camera left, but he's camera right of you. And I still don't understand it, but I've just learned to be very good at styling it out. And I go, oh yeah, of course, obviously. But it's that the line, they talk about the line of looking left to right or right to left. And it's basically like the offside rule. I think most people say they understand it and most people don't.
I feel like I have gotten my own taste of that problem thanks to Zoom interviews where when I want to point to something, like I never know what side
of the
screen I'm going to. I got nothing. All right. Number 2. We've got
I love that.
4 is called More TV, Please. If you could guest star on the show of your choice, what would you pick and why?
Ooh. Oh my God. Well, at the moment, I'd want to be someone absolutely revolting in Bridgerton. But I wouldn't want to be someone glamorous. I'd want to be an absolute asshole with no makeup, some horrible wig, my boobs flattened down, and yeah, I'd want to be unrecognizable, kind of Game of Thrones style again.
All right, one more. And we've got a 7. That's a wrap. Strangest wrap gift you've ever received?
My face lasered onto a tree trunk.
What was this for?
It was a wrap. It was a wrap gift for a thing called The Only Boy for Me. And I undid it, and for the first time ever, could not style it out. I was like, that's my face on a piece of wood.
Where does this piece live now?
At my parents' house, because when I said, look at this ridiculous thing, my dad went, well, I think that's rather unusual and smart. And I went, you keep it then. And so it sits on my parents' windowsill in their kitchen. And every time I look at it, I'm like, really? Well, honestly, if I showed you it, you'd be like, yeah, that's, I still don't quite understand that. It's like they couldn't think of anything else. So they're like, okay, what can I find that's the most random thing in the world? Trying to feign thanks for that was hard, even if I am an actor.
I get your confusion about the gift, but I understand your parents keeping it. I feel like that is totally something that my mother would never let me throw away, and she would wind up, you know, displaying where people could see it.
Yeah, I mean, but God, it's just so odd, I suppose, that they're... And it was a really weird, like, old picture of me, and I just thought, I don't know what's going on here, so I'm just going to give it to my parents. It was like some weird stalky fan, but it was one of the actors. Very odd.
All right. Jumping into some credit, actually not a specific credit to start. I was very curious, what did the dream first look like when you were first starting out? Did you want it to be exclusively theater at the beginning, or did you always know that you wanted to explore all forms of storytelling and performance?
That's exactly what it is, storytelling and performance. I mean, I've sung all my life. I remember, you know, when people say to me, when did you decide you wanted to be a performer, full stop? I remember distinctly hearing that people sat behind desks in offices. And I remember thinking, they what? They do what? They go to the same what? And do what with papers and pen and what? I remember my brain not being able to compute that rather than how am I going to do this? I remember thinking, well, I know what I'm doing. It's nothing to do with that. And I think in terms of theatre versus television, it was never really my intention to go into long runs of musical theatre, because they can be quite exhausting. You know, in general, it's wonderful. If you get a contract, it's usually like a year, 9 months or whatever. So I never intended to do that because I knew my boredom threshold was quite low. And I had always intended to do screen work and then do separate concerts or short runs or, you know, that kind of thing. And I just kind of fell into musical theatre in a way because, you know, these great directors just offered me these wonderful roles, you know, things like, I mean, working with Mike Nichols in Spamalot and Sir Trevor Nunn, who's directed me 3 times. It's things like that. I wouldn't change a beat of it now, but at the time I remember thinking, oh God, I've just signed on for a year of something, and that wasn't my intention. But it was obviously right for me at the time, because it made me a grafter. It made everything that I do honest and muscular, because you have to look after yourself in theatre. If you're on stage 8 shows a week, it is your life. So my discipline is very good because of that. And I think when you get into theatre, you don't get into it to become a star. You do it for the camaraderie and to play great parts. And that's something that has stayed with me always. It is always about the part, whether they look fabulous or look like they've just been dug up. It's always about the part and what I can eke out of that muscularly.
Do you find any similar qualities now working a lot in film and television as far as that camaraderie goes? Because I love emphasizing the importance of that, because I think it's something that is absolutely vital to the business, and we just don't talk about it and highlight it nearly enough.
It is vital, and particularly on Ted Lasso. I mean, I always refer to us all as a company of players, theatre players, because the ball bounces around so happily, and there is not one person in this show that thinks they're more important than anyone else. And I mean that hand on heart. And I think that comes across on camera. The ball bounces constantly and there's nobody, you know, just doing their own thing. least of all Jason. He'll literally lie down and let somebody take a scene away from him at the drop of a hat. He will make it all about everyone else. And which is why, you know, when he created this character, he is the Ted Lasso vibe, you know? He doesn't just play the character, he embodies it as well, because he will always push us all to the front.
True Ted Lasso quality.
Yeah, he does. He does. And that's why, you know, he's written this, because it's obviously coursing through his veins. And I think that we all realized that very early on. And so we treat this show as the jewel that he created.
When you were first starting out in TV, I know you did a whole bunch of guest appearances on a variety of shows. Was there anyone in particular that made the biggest impression on you as far as helping you figure out what's important to you when signing on for something moving forward?
I think it was Game of Thrones, really. I'd done a lot before that, but it was the first time I had looked so utterly hideous in something. And I remember at the time, you know, I walked into the makeup trailer and about 3 seconds later was vomited out, and they'd added in the hairs where you take them out of your eyebrows and stippled my cheeks and made me look bloodshot and all the rest of it. And at first I was literally like the Edward Munch, like, scream picture, because I was thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be on international television looking like an absolute sack of shit. But once I'd got into her and into the fact that she is this deeply, deeply devout character who would have never looked in a mirror in her life, was there for the cause, for the Order of the Seven, and devoted to the High Sparrow, when a new makeup artist came along in season 6 and tried to do the no makeup, I was like, whoa, no. And it informed me so much about looking inwards instead of giving a shit what you look like on camera. It just so happens that for Rebecca in particular, I worked a lot with our head of hair and makeup, Nikki Austin, and with Jackie Levy, our extraordinary costume designer, and said, I want Rebecca to look utterly, utterly flawless, because every single inch of her inside is at odds. So that was extremely important, to go completely the other end of the spectrum for Rebecca. So that's kind of where I start. I see the look in my head and then I work from there.
So hard for me not to jump straight into Game of Thrones, but I did want to ask you a little bit about Les Mis, because that just seems like such an incredible set to be on. And the way that they recorded the vocals on that is fairly unique. So can you kind of paint a picture of what it was like stepping onto that set and doing that particular song there?
Well, talking about the whole fact that we all just had in-ear little things and just like a synthesizer, like a little keyboard playing. So they hadn't even done all the orchestrations then. So we just had, like, for that end of the day number, we had literally on a keyboard somebody going bam bam da 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 da. That's all we had to keep that metronome of time. And at first we were all like, oh my God, this is crazy. But then you think, hold on a minute, we've all been in musical theater for years, we sing everything live, it's exactly the same as we would usually be on a live stage. So it was ingenious of them to do it like that. And I think the greatest thing about stepping on that set was, in our particular world there, that factory world, every single person, every single woman along those benches was hugely established in musical theater in their own right. Some of us doing one line here and one line there. And we all just wanted to be there because, you know, Tom Hooper, my God, the director, so knew what he was doing. And lovely Anne Hathaway and Hugh Jackman were very much theatre bods on it. You know, it was a complete pleasure to be on it. But more than them, a real pleasure to stand next to my contemporaries, one of whom was playing Fantine on the stage that night. It was extraordinary. It was a real, just kind of doing it for the love of it, because we wanted it to go down on the silver screen and be kept forever.
I love the way it's shot too, because it does such a good job of highlighting so many individuals in the ensemble and making sure that they make an impression and the visuals are seared in your brain, even with such limited screen time. And that's a real art to achieve.
But I don't know whether you noticed this, Tom Hooper's conceit was that you don't see anyone, he could have had everyone as an ensemble of players in every scene, but slightly disguised. He didn't have any two people in any of the worlds. So the whores wouldn't have been in the factory scene, you know? Every single, the huge cast for that, but it was inspired because it makes sure that you move into each world where of course you would see different individuals.
Something else, revisiting, right. I purposely revisited a lot of your work, and it was like, actually this is true of every single title I was revisiting. It's impossible to just play your scene and then not continue on with the movie or show. So
yeah,
watched a lot of Game of Thrones, Les Mis, and Sex Education.
Well, I make a point of only choosing things or letting things in that I think are remarkable. Otherwise, I'd rather be out of work.
Now, you're definitely accomplishing that right now. All right, let's jump into Game of Thrones full force. Kind of answered my curiosity about like the creative enthusiasm involved with playing a character like that. But can you walk us through the audition?
My God, Harry, the audition was, well, for a start, I was just under 8.5 months pregnant at the time. I was pregnant from the cheekbones out. I mean, I was like a ship in full sail, just gargantuan. And I went into this meeting and I was like, okay, bear in mind, I was only going there. I thought there's no way I'm going to get this part because I'm heavily pregnant and clearly just about to pop. And I thought, but the good thing is, because I'd been doing theater, I knew of this Game of Thrones phenomenon, but I hadn't seen any of it. So I went along and I literally went along to audition for the casting director, Nina Gold, kind of like to say hello for next time when I wasn't with child. And so I went in very relaxed and I walked in and it was a room full of elderly women who were almost as wide as they were tall. And I was like, I even rang my agent and went, I genuinely, I'm not joking, I genuinely think I'm in the wrong place. Because, you know, I'm 6'2 in heels. And with my pregnant bump as well, I was literally twice their height and probably half their age. And I was just like, I don't think this is right. And she went, oh no, did I not tell you, you're their wild card? So by then I was just like, this is going to be hilarious. I'm going to be in and out the door in 2 seconds. It's fine. I walked in, did the audition, and it was the bit with the ladle feeding Cersei the water and then smacking her, and you know. And I just got a bit too much into it. And I accidentally, it was a wooden spoon and a wooden ladle, wooden spoon and a wooden bowl. And I accidentally, with my sweaty hand, flung the ladle at the casting director's shin. And when I was called in for my recall, David Benioff and Dan Weiss both went, by the way, we just have to tell you that your first take was hilarious because you're the scariest woman we've ever seen and your gaze at the end of it was terrifying, like you were going to kill us. And then when you thought it had cut and you flung the ladle at the casting director's shin and went, oh my God, darling, I'm so sorry. They absolutely howled with laughter. They were like, who is this woman?
There needs to be some sort of like a bonus feature somewhere where we
can see that footage somewhere, because it really made me laugh that it was Dan Weiss was just like, seriously, it was like you were this terrifying woman and then suddenly you were your ridiculous self apologizing for hurting someone.
Is that a common thing? Because it's the first time I've ever heard of an audition being referred to as a wild card, where, you know, they'll bring in a bunch of people that like visually suit the role as they imagine and then just say like, these are our wild cards.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never heard of that before or since, but if you'd seen them, you'd have been like, Han, you are definitely the wild card in here and it's not going to go your way.
This is going to sound ridiculously specific right now, but it's not every day that we have a one word line of dialogue become so iconic. Was there any playing around with the way to deliver the word shame or any specificity involved there?
Well, David Nutter, the director, actually, when he and I first met, we were in Dubrovnik, Old Town, obviously, where King's Landing was set, certainly for season 5. And he called me into this kind of big boardroom in the hotel we were all staying in. He was like, look, I know that I don't need to go through this with you because of your singing background, but if you can find a pitch and I'm appealing to you as a singer, as a musician, find a pitch, one that you can maintain, and two, that is something that she has done all her life, because she is the henchman to the High Sparrow, and a tone that lets everyone know there's no mucking about with this character. And I stood at the other end of the room, and I said, well, I hear her like this, and I did it. And he went, well, that's the shortest meeting I've ever had. I'll see you tomorrow. And that was that.
That's incredible. Great success, because I will never not hear it the exact way you deliver it. And I mean, is it kind of crazy that you've become a highly shareable meme because of that one word?
Crazy. It's crazy. And people tell me all the time, the amount of interviews I do, and people say, you know, that was always the thing that in our office, we've got a bell, and then someone says that. And I love it. I mean, what's not to love? And David and Dan loved the fact that everyone went nuts for that character as well. It's, you know, she wasn't meant to come back in season six, but they emailed me and said, look, everyone has loved the fact that somebody has finally come up against Cersei. We have to give her a really sticky end. Would you be up for it? And I was like, hello, yes, of course. So season six was such a welcome surprise.
What was her ending meant to be in season five? Like what was the closing of the door for the character then?
You weren't going to see her. That was it. Cersei goes back into the Red Keep, and that's it. But because of the success of the character, they brought her back, and then you see her with Nat Dormer's character making her a tone. And I love that so many of my friends were like, oh God, that's not going to end well for that one either. And of course I got to work with Dame Diana Rigg, which was just such a privilege. God,
I really can't imagine that character's story going any other way.
No.
I always love asking about the value of having a good scene partner, someone who supports your work in addition to delivering their work well on their own. And when it comes to Game of Thrones, it seems like that's of the utmost importance for the scenes that you share with Lena. And I mean, it's pretty much every single scene that you guys share together seems incredibly demanding to me. So what was it like working together, and what were you two able to do for each other to make those scenes, I don't know, maybe not like miserably challenging, or maybe that's how I'm perceiving them.
I think the key with Lena and myself was we immediately got on. We're both what we would call here birds. We're not like fluffy girly girls. We got on immediately. We really dig each other from the word go. And I think that we just realized that it was very much a bit of teamwork on that. And which she and I are friends still today. And if you think about how little time that we actually spent on that together, that makes me feel like they got the chemistry right there. And I was acutely aware of coming into something where she had been carving out such a magnificent three-dimensional character for five seasons. I owed it to her and to her detailed work to come in and bolster that up around her. So I'm just glad that it was so well received and that she and I are still very silly friends.
I was reading one other thing, I guess another potential change for Unella that had me wondering, because I was reading that her demise originally was way worse than what we saw in the final product. So I guess, dare I ask, what could be worse than what we saw?
She was meant to be raped by the Mountain. And I think they'd had so many complaints about the rape of Sansa that they chose not to go with it. But unbelievably, they changed it quite at the last minute. I think they possibly changed it when I was midair flying to Belfast, because suddenly I got sent these new sides that said that I would need a wetsuit top. And I thought they'd sent me the wrong bits. And sure enough, when I got there, I was then put in a wetsuit top. And I was like, because, and they went, oh, it's going to be, it's waterboarding instead. And I was like, oh, but we're not actually doing water, but no, we are. And there I was, strapped to a wooden table with proper big straps for 10 hours. And definitely, other than childbirth, it was the worst day of my life, because Lena was uncomfortable pouring liquid in my face for that long. And I was beside myself. But in those moments, you have to think, do you serve the peace and get on with it? Or do you chicken out and go, no, this isn't what I signed up for, blah, blah, blah. And then the funny thing was, after we'd finished shooting it the whole day, and people like Miguel Sapochnik, the director, by the way, walking past with a cup of tea and a sandwich on the go and going, hi, Anna, you all right? And I was like, not really. I've just been, you know, the crew have just been saying, we are actually really waterboarding you here. And I was like, yep, you don't need to tell me that. When I got back to the hotel that night, I was going up in the lift and I was standing next to Eugene, who had had to crawl through loads of shit to get out of the sept of Baylor. and he was like, oh my God, what happened to you today? I could barely speak because I'd been screaming through the mountain's hand, which is quite frightening as a singer to completely lose your voice. So I had no voice at all to barely whisper, bruises already coming up like I'd been attacked. And I was like, basically just been waterboarded for 10 hours. And he went, mate, I've just been crawling through shit for 4 days on my elbows. We were like, see, you haven't been in Game of Thrones unless you've been really, really battered around.
Well, I'm going to cheat at my dice game. I want to bring back one question that we didn't know here, because I'm curious if it might apply to this. What is one thing that you had to do for a movie or a show that now makes you say, I'm glad I did that, but never, ever again?
There we go. That waterboarding, because I hadn't even realized that it definitely gave me claustrophobia around water. Definitely. I hadn't realized until I watched a program where the camera's down on the actor's face and they're being dipped into the water, but you see them face up to camera. And I got in a terrible panic about it. And I actually went and had a bit of a chat to somebody about it, because it's quite full on being waterboarded for 10 hours. And then only 1 minute and 30 seconds to be used on camera.
I don't mean to harp on this, but it is making me wonder, like, what would you say to another actor who is about to do something? Like, is there any way to film a scene like that and make it feel authentic in the final product, but without actually suffering any trauma?
Well, you have to remember, you know, when I was strapped there, and as a singer, I was the one thing that I was really worried about, I didn't want the strap tight around my neck. But as they pointed out, if the camera can see you lifting your head up to save yourself, that's not authentic. And it was Dan Bice that came up to me and went, look, in the script it says Cersei empties the remainder of her glass of red wine to wake up Unella. People aren't going to think that's enough. You know, what you've put her character through, that is not enough retribution for Cersei, especially the kind of person that she is. It needs to be more like a 3/4 full, or so if we can cheat it even more, carafe of wine. And that's what I mean about that moment of fight or flight. I just thought, you know what? The one thing I kept thinking to myself, the production company aren't going to let you die. So get on with it, be uncomfortable. And this is what I, like you were saying in your question, I would say, get on with it. As long as you feel like there's not any genuine threat of something happening, push yourself, be uncomfortable. It's the same as, you know, if people don't cry on camera, don't impart this emotion to the right moment, you know, why not? Why not? My whole thing has always been, take people to the absolute nth degree of their emotions. And that's the same thing. Give of yourself, and then it gives back to you.
I feel like I have to jump into Ted Lasso now because I have so many questions, but I do want to sneak in one sex education question. Maybe I want to ask you for a season 3 tease so badly, but I know you probably can't say anything. I guess maybe, like, just not if this is the case. Is it safe to assume that we are going to see how Jackson and Sophia's talk in season 2 winds up influencing the family dynamic moving forward?
Yes, but we are barely in season 3 because I was busy doing Ted Lasso. I mean, barely. But I will tell you that season three and my boy Jackson, Kedar, his contribution becomes increasingly beautiful.
I like that tea. So, like, I'm being greedy now. You're giving me Ted Lasso, but taking away a little sex education. Yeah. I want everything. All right. So, Ted Lasso. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe let's start with the burning question first. Everybody wants to know, are the biscuits actually any good?
No.
What do they taste like?
They taste like they possibly could have been a nice biscuit at some point, but had been left out in the air for weeks. I mean, they're better than they were last season, to be fair. I think because they've heard me complaining about them so publicly for so long, they're like, we better slightly improve them. So they're a little bit more buttery this time. Okay. But I always say to people, it's my own fault because I decided to make her an emotional eater as a result of Ted bringing them into her life. So no one's ever asked me to eat them as vociferously as I do. But I just feel that that's what she would do. And that's why I sniffed the box as well, because it's like her fix.
So you're actually eating the biscuits on set for multiple takes, or is it a situation where, you know, you got to...
Oh, no, no, I eat them. Oh, yeah, no, I just get on that. Oh, yeah, I can't be doing the whole spit bucket thing. No, 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 no.
We used to play a Would You Rather game all the time. And one of my favorite questions to ask was, would you rather have to eat throughout an entire scene or run throughout an entire scene?
Oh, God, eat. 100% eat. Right. Yeah. And in fact, Juno, in a previous interview we were doing, said that she's noticed that I do get it down to a fine art, the choreography of how much of a biscuit I start with in the scene to make it look like I've already been eating the biscuit, and the gap when I pop it in my mouth or put it on the plate or whatever. Because I just think that it's like, it's that emotional thing of Rebecca. When she's done something that she's a bit scared of, she's like,
Yeah, I can relate all too well. So you were talking about this a little bit earlier, but do you remember the moment either in pre-production or while you were on set where something clicked and you realized that this is like a next level special show? Like, we don't get stuff like this that often. This is definitely on that other tier.
I think it was when we were shooting the gala, episode 4, and we finally meet Rupert, old Mannion. When Anthony Head showed up, everything changed for me. I already knew who she was with Rebecca. And then when he turns up and she's blinded by the light and can't really see who it is, but knows the voice, that gave me an extra layer of Rebecca that she's previously talked about. But then when you actually see them in the flesh together, and it just fit perfectly. And also it's the first time when we see her and Keely really leaning on each other properly. And we see that that's a sign of things to come. And I think everyone brought out their characters more in that episode than any of the other episodes. It was just, like I say about the ball bouncing from one character to another, I think that episode was outstanding, and especially in terms of the camera work as well. It was just, I'll always remember that episode as being like the springboard that made me realize I was in something really special.
I think I feel what you're describing there while watching that episode. So Rebecca has like a very lengthy journey front, like she's pretty much teed up as the villain of the show at the very beginning. And then obviously, all right, wait, before I even ask this question, I should put up a big old spoiler warning right now for our viewership. So yes. If you have not seen Ted Lasso in full, this is the point of the video where you push pause, you go binge it on Apple TV Plus, and I'm warning you, you're going to have to binge the entire thing straight through. Then when you come back to this video, all you do is press play, and it starts right here. So this is it. We're going to go for it right now. All right. So Rebecca starts out as a villain, teed up as a villain at least, and we hit the redemption at the end. But all throughout, I love how subtly the show adds moments of vulnerability that basically set up the fact that she is going on this journey. So what was it like kind of peppering those in? And were there ever any moments in the show where you guys kind of had to workshop how much you wanted to, you know, show those cards?
No, because I think the writing is so exquisite that I was discovering her softness and her hard shell every day. I had no idea that she was going to have come from such a verbally abusive relationship. I had no idea of the arc with the old Rebecca, new Rebecca thing and the pregnancy and all of that. I had no idea. But bizarrely, what I'd created for myself as a backstory was that when she and Rupert got together, she probably would have been around 30, and that she was very keen to have children, and so put her own career on a back burner to try and convince him. He had always said that he didn't want to have children. This was all in my own head, that he'd never wanted to have children. And so she had chosen man or child, and she'd stuck with the man. And can you imagine how weird it was then when I was given episode 9 and Rupert comes in and says, no, I just didn't want a child. And honestly, that one scene that goes from on the verge of confessing to Ted, to the funniness of her embarrassment at talking, to Ted's rewinding the scene, to going out and thinking, no, I've got to be accountable for my shit. I've taught Keely that you must be accountable. Then to see the switch of Rupert coming in and saying all of that, and then walking and telling Ted, that whole sequence that I think MJ Delaney just masterfully directed, that whole sequence, it gives me goose pimples just talking about it. That whole sequence, I had no idea that that was going to be the storyline. But in my head, I had created that she was a woman who had missed the boat with her fertility.
The baby reveal scene is one of the most crushing things that I've ever watched. And I'm not just saying this because you're on the show. That like one performance beat might be one of my favorite elements throughout the entire series, because when he delivers that line, the camera is on you and it's like mostly dialogue less, and you go through such a range of emotions just on your face conveying a lot of that history that you just brought up and who she is now and trying to be strong in front of him. So I don't know, like I don't even have a good specific sub question. I just wanted to like ramble that out and ask you, what was it like doing that reaction?
Well, do you know what was amazing about that? We had shot Anthony Head's coverage during the day, and then they weren't going to be coming around for my coverage for some reason until later. And I think Anthony saw my face fall because we were so much in the moment. I think it was like over lunch or something. They were going to like, they went, oh, we'll come back to this after lunch. And I was just like, And he went, and he said, oh, they said, oh, Anthony, you've wrapped for the day, because the next bit was going to be me turning round to walk down the stairs to go and confess to Ted. And you know what that man did? This is what I mean about it being a company of theatre players. He stayed and waited. And before the camera rolled, he spat a load of nasty, shitty words about her and him in my ear, so that when I turned round, I was back where I needed to be. That is special casting.
Goes back to the value of a scene partner. That's the stuff I love hearing about. Let's throw that kind of question over to Jason and the apology scene, which, you know, it's another like monologue that I thought was just so beautifully delivered. That monologue, I guess, is mostly covered in your single. What can he be doing for you kind of off camera as a scene partner to best support your work in that moment?
What he always does, which is to be utterly in the moment and listening to the point where you can feel that he's feeling every breath. And the most important thing in that from him was something he does elsewhere as well. He does it in the scene when we're standing outside the gala and he comes to her and is wondering, you know, it's the first time she breaks down to him, but he did it as well in this scene. He, because of his exquisite writing ability, he carried on ad-libbing a bit when, at the moment when Rebecca's confessed, you know, when he talks about divorce is hard, he carried on and really lent into me so much that it was almost like he was playing with my own emotions to get out of me what was needed on camera. So you've got a writer, a fellow actor, and a director, and the creator of the show making you look good on camera.
everything about this show makes me so happy. What's in the final product and now what I hear about how it went down behind the scenes.
Yes, it's I always say to people, the next job I'm on, I'm going to struggle. I'm not going to lie, because it's the people on this are special. And I've said before that the casting of this gave me a whole gaggle of new people in my life that I didn't realize I needed, but now I know I won't ever be without.
This next question's kind of more of a, you know, it's like a theory type question and getting a little creative with it at this point, now that we know that the trajectory she's on. But what do you think might have happened if the coach that Rebecca hired to ruin the team wasn't Ted Lasso? Do you think that ultimately she would have been successful at just ruining everything and being happy that she did that to Rupert? Or do you still think that there's a chance that she would have seen the error in her ways and have changed?
I think it would have been a longer line. I think she would have ruined the team quicker, got what she thought she needed, and somewhere down the line would have realized that it had only crept her deeper into absolute depression. And I mean, I genuinely think we find Rebecca at a precipice, and had Ted not come along, I think she would have been in terrible trouble.
You're probably right. I do think that Keely is a good backup. Like, if Ted was her safety net, Keely was right behind and would have been the one to catch her.
Yeah, yes. But that's what I mean about it being, it would have been further down the line. Yeah. Because I also think that Keely comes into Rebecca's life as a result of the interaction between Keely, Ted, and Rebecca with the panda lion scene, which I just think is brilliant. You know, to have that initial spike towards Keely, I think that would have been a slow burn, that she would have actually got into, you know, when she's throwing him under the bus with the photo shoot. I think somewhere down the line, she would have thought back on that conversation and thought, that girl was silly and funny. I liked her. I wish I hadn't done that to her.
The relationship between those two characters is a major, major highlight for me. So now... It's come to the point where I got to ask you a tease for season two. I know you probably can't say anything. So maybe just like.
No, maybe don't, Carrie. I'm terrible.
Broad and light. Is there any, you know, next step that you're looking forward to audiences seeing Rebecca take?
Well, universally, I think Jason put it brilliantly. And I'm referencing the stormtrooper behind you. Jason has described season two as The Empire Strikes Back. And I'm inclined to agree with him. And everything I've heard, because, you know, we are so precious about this show that I'm not going to lie. I was nervous to see how, for everyone, not just my character, I was thinking, oh God, you know, we've created such a honey. How do we not let the fans down, or where they think it'll go or whatever? And the brilliant thing is the writers are on their own journey and have done us all such a service, such a great service. I was worried that Rebecca would suddenly be this brand new person, that she has strength and happiness in her life. She realizes she doesn't have to be like that. She's been forgiven, da da da. She's suddenly this perky person. And I'm so glad that we find her with some moments of strength, but then the whole two steps forward, one step back, one step forward, two steps back. And I was really relieved that we see everyone's flaws and good things as well, because that is the human condition, isn't it? You're not suddenly better.
That is an excellent tease right there. And gives me all the faith world that season two will have all the charm that I've come to love in season one, but also that added depth too, that makes sure, yes, that the content sticks with you and can,
yes,
truly believe the show can inspire change for anybody who watches it.
100%.
All right, we have hit our second game of the episode. We are doing cast superlatives. So I'll give you the superlative and you tell me which Ted Lasso cast member best fits this descriptor and why.
Oh.
Life of the party.
Katie Jones.
Would that be Juno Temple?
Oh, Juno Temple, yeah. Juno Temple.
Let's go best footballer.
Oh God, if any of the boys watch this, I'm going to be in such trouble. Can I say definitely not Roy Kent or Brett Goldstein? I will say, oh, it's a toss-up between, if we're talking the real actor, I would say it's a toss-up between Phil Dunster as Jamie Tart and Tahib Jamot as Sam Abusanya.
That does not surprise me one bit.
Yeah, I can't kind of decide between they're both demons. They can both really, really do it.
How about most likely to break out in song?
Hello, me.
I wanted to give you one layup there. How about most changed? Like someone who changed the most from day one of making the show to where they are now?
Ooh, that's a hard one because I actually don't think people have changed. I think because we are a company of people who are not young in particular, I think what makes it a happy camp is that we all know who we are and we all like to sit in the mix together. Nobody's trying to be more starry than anyone else. So I don't know, I'm gonna have to pass on that one. I don't think anyone's really changed, and I think that's a good thing.
Who could probably make the best biscuits?
Ooh. Probably Brett Goldstein. Yeah, because he's a demon pie maker.
Ooh, all right. Mm. That's some good reasoning there.
Yeah, he gives a good lattice pie.
Yeah. Our last one here. Who is most like their character on the show?
I'm not sure that anyone is really... I'm definitely much more silly than Rebecca and much more gangly and tomboyish and, you know... I would say probably the most unlike the character I would say is probably Nick Mohammed. I mean, he has his moments of being like Nate, but in the main, he's far more of a cool cat and very charming and twinkly and not that kind of get off the grass. You know, he's not that.
We have come to the end. I've already kept you too long. We always end Ladies Night with the same two questions. First one is, can you name someone who you think is changing the industry for the better?
Viola Davis. I think she's just an absolute Trojan. I think she's magnificent.
I think that's an excellent answer. And this last one is a little heavy. You could take it in a lighter direction if you prefer. What is the biggest fear you've ever had that you've actually managed to overcome?
Ooh. Oh, God, that's a good one, Perry. Do you know what? I'd probably say it was in the moment of lying on that torture table. I just thought, I don't think I can do this. I don't think they realize how terrified of water I am. I mean, really, I've never dived because I'm terrified of going headfirst into water. I can't dive. So yeah, that's the first thing that springs to my mind, that because in general, I'm very much one for feel the fear and do it anyway. And as a single mother, you face fears every day. The overwhelming responsibility of being the main person in their life and being a good example to them. But yeah, on a practical level, that day I was like, we can either get out or get going on this. Yeah, so probably that.
I have to let you, I could ask you a million more questions about all your life. It's too easy to talk to, but I gotta let you go. And I'm gonna let all of our viewers out there know, season one of Ted Lasso, you can binge it in full on Apple TV Plus right now. Season two, it arrives on July 23rd. I like enjoying every day, but I want all these days to go by super fast. So I can see the second season. And I cannot congratulate you enough on Ted Lasso and everything you've accomplished. Thank you for hanging out with us on Ladies Night.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure. Really has, genuinely.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.